Hey, good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Welcome to tonight's program, The Mike Malloy Show. I was just looking at one of these, where'd it go? One of these crazy emails. Where'd it go? Oh, here it is. It's from David Razba at ATT.net. Hey, Mike, be sure to mention the quake in Haiti and especially those rotten Christians who are already there on the front lines of helping during this disaster. CNN, Fox, CNNBC, the only people they get in contact with tonight in Haiti were Christians. Wonder how many atheists are there or plan to get there as soon as possible to help out. Oh, my God. Thanks for tuning in. In about an hour and a half, we will have a chat with Rachel Maddow, whose program ends at 10 Eastern. She'll be on this program, 10:30 Eastern. So we're looking forward to that. We have several, I'm a little bit scattered here because we have an awful lot that is spooky. As my crazed emailer suggested, David, yeah, bad earthquake in Haiti. So far, of course, there's nobody there and helping. It's impossible to get into the country. It's impossible to get out. Haiti is not the place you want a 7.0 earthquake. Haiti's not the place you want a 1.0 earthquake. Haiti has long been part of the Western Hemisphere that no white people ever wanted to acknowledge. It was a slave colony, and until it got its independence. And since it got its independence in the Western Hemisphere, the white power structure has totally ignored it, including, of course, all the Christians, except the Catholics, who had a firm stranglehold on that country and convinced the people to stay sick and poor and diseased, because in the next life, everything would be fine. The death toll, who knows at this point? A 7.0 quake is a pretty big one, and apparently this was centered inland. It was actually in the country of Haiti. So if any reports come available during the program, we'll certainly pass them on. You know by now that major U.S. banks are getting ready to announce their annual bonuses for top executives. I've read on several business websites, including CNN Business and a couple other ones, CNBC, that $500,000 is the kind of bonus would be paid to bank tellers, all the way up to $1.6 billion to some of the executives. That's pretty astonishing. And the banking industry, the executives, you know, they're supposed to meet tomorrow, I guess, and there's supposed to be hearings tomorrow. I think they start tomorrow. Or did they start today? I don't know. I think it's tomorrow. Bank executives are to wend their way to Washington to sit in front of committees. It's the 2010 version of the Pecora Commission, a member of Congress who held hearings after the stock market crash in 1929. And as a result of the Pecora hearings, legislation like Glass-Steagall was passed to prevent it from ever happening again. And then the Republicans and Bill Clinton, of course, decimated that back in 1996, 7, 8, somewhere back there. And the predators, the capitalist predators, immediately started devouring everything in this country. And pretty much have stripped us right down to the bone and the skin. They continue, however, to make enormous sums of money out of thin air. They're not producing anything. They're not advancing anything. They're not lending any money. They're just selling debt back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They still find suckers, global suckers, who will buy this garbage. And we, the American public, continue to underwrite it. We are led by people in this country, Republican and Democrat, who mostly Republican, but enough Democrats, who insist, including our president, by the way, who insists that in order to save America, you have to save the banking industry. the bankers should be tried and found guilty of all sorts of fraud and put in prison for a long time and told to keep their just take it away from them, socialize, nationalize all the banks. Every single bank in the country should be shut down for maybe 24, 48 hours. And in that time frame, all of them nationalized. Before they're shut down, there should be a national banking board appointed of economists, not bankers, who operate at the pleasure of the President of the United States until such time as these appointments can be sorted out and administered by representatives of the people. That would be the Congress of the United States. But there has to be a shaking out period where the members of Congress are purged, the ones who continue to take money from these rapacious bastards and continue to screw the system. It's completely interwoven, interlinked, and it's going to be extremely difficult to stop the predatory bankers and stop the members of Congress who allow them to be predatory. This is a problem. The lawmakers are in on it. So anything short of open revolution, I sure would like to hear about, because I don't know how this will ever stop. In the meantime, the entire society is being slowly sunk, just sunk. Incredible stuff. The number of multi-million-dollar bonus payments are likely to be off the chart this year. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs told reporters yesterday that many bank executives, quote, just continue not to get it, unquote, referring to public displeasure with all this, these bonuses. But Mr. Gibbs, of course, is, I mean, he's right as far as he goes, but why should the bankers get it? They have absolute permission to continue to do what they're doing. Nobody's stopping them. And every time there's a failure, and the failures will continue. There's no way to stop the failures because there's no way to stop the game unless the banks are nationalized. And every time there's a failure, there will be more money printed and the U.S. taxpayers will go on the hook for even more debt. This is madness. This is madness. And the ultra wealthy will continue to get ultra wealthier until finally what? What is being done to save the country? I've been reading about the business renaissance in Detroit. Yeah, really. A pizza parlor opened. There's a hair salon that opened. What else opened? A little restaurant that makes crepes. That opened. Yeah, there you go. They held the auto show in Detroit. Hey, okay. That's cool. Wow, man. This is madness. You know it is. So until the banking system in this country is blown up, and we start over again with a nationalized banking system where the predators, the pot stirrers, the thieves, the liars, the cheats, the sneaks, cannot get their hands. In other words, the capitalists cannot get their hands on it. Until such time as the Federal Reserve is completely blown up and, the right to print money becomes the right of the government. Oh, man, I'm just whistling in the wind. I know I am. Hey, I have a letter from Albert Einstein that I want to share with you when we come back. Steve sent this to me. It is from a website called lettersofnote.com. And it is a letter that Albert Einstein wrote to a friend of his, Eric Gutkind, a philosopher. After reading Mr. Gutkind's book, Choose Life, The Biblical Call to Revolt. And the letter's fairly quick. I want you to hear this. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. Strikes across the frontier and strikes for higher wage. Planet lurches to the right as ideologies engage. Suddenly it's repression, moratorium on right. What did they think the politics of panic would invite?
the world that we live in, where no one gives a damn about the future of children. Just building a cash flow, making a bank account. Let us expose the truth. Is that what the war's about? Because I don't
time
understand.
To practice your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy. All the turmoil's
making my blood boil. Because I don't want to see 21. Wow. Come on, don't lose your voice. 21 past the hour. Steve sent this to me earlier today. In January 1954, just a year before his death, Albert Einstein wrote the letter I'm going to share with you to philosopher Eric Gutkind. After reading Gutkind's book, Choose Life, The Biblical Call to Revolt, apparently Einstein had only read the book due to repeated recommendation by a mutual friend. The letter was bought at auction in May 2008 for 170,000 British pounds. Unsurprisingly, one of the successful bidders was Richard Dawkins. Here's the letter. Princeton, March 1st, 1954. Dear Mr. Gutkind, inspired by Brouwer's repeated suggestion, I read a great deal in your book, and thank you very much for lending it to me. With regard to the factual attitude to life and to the human community, we have a great deal in common. Your personal ideal with its striving for freedom from ego-oriented desires, for making life beautiful and noble, with an emphasis on the purely human element, unites us as having an so-called American attitude, end quote. Still, without Brouwer's suggestion, I would never have gotten myself to engage intensively with your book because it is written in a language inaccessible to me. The word God is for me nothing more than the expression and product of human weakness. The Bible, a collection of honorable but still purely primitive legends, which are nevertheless pretty childish. No interpretation, no matter how subtle, can, for me, change this. For me, the Jewish religion, like all other religions, is an incarnation of the most childish superstition. And the Jewish people, to whom I gladly belong, have no different quality for me than all other people. As far as my experience goes, they are also no better than other human groups, although they, the Jews, are protected from the worst cancers by a lack of power. Otherwise, I cannot see anything, quote, chosen, end quote, about them. In general, I find it painful that you claim a privileged position and try to defend it by two walls of pride, an external one as a man and an internal one as a Jew. As a man, you claim, so to speak, a dispensation from causality otherwise accepted as a Jew of monotheism. But a limited causality is no longer a causality at all, as our wonderful Spinoza recognized with all incision. Now that I've quite openly stated our differences in intellectual convictions, it is still clear to me that we are quite close to each other in essential things, i.e., in our evaluation of human behavior. I think that we would understand each other quite well if we talked about concrete things. With friendly thanks and best wishes, yours, A. Einstein. God is nothing more than the expression and product of human weakness. Now, he dwells heavily because the author of the book and Einstein himself were Jewish, but as he makes it very clear, he says, for me, the Jewish religion, like all other religions, is an incarnation of the most childish superstition. The word God for me is nothing more than the expression and product of human weakness. The Bible, a collection of honorable but still purely primitive legends, which are nevertheless pretty childish. So, I know. It's just one person's opinion. And besides, he was never able to find the theory of everything anyway. The unification, oh, he found the unification church, I guess, but the unified field theory. Yeah, the guts, the grand unification theories, unified field theory, and so on and so forth. So, since he couldn't find that, there you go. All right, we're going to take a break and come back momentarily. What else we got? We got a lot of stuff here. Oh, Palin is going to be in Las Vegas for an event. I have to share this one with you. Sarah Palin, what a piece of work this broad is. I swear to God. He called her a broad. That's sexist. Yeah. Yeah, it is. When's she going to be there? Well, she'll be there soon. And I will tell you what the event is when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. I believe in God, breathe air. It's too thin. This far from heaven. This far from heaven and stars. Stars.
Lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour. Sarah Palin plans to address an industry event in Las Vegas. It's the alcohol industry. As CNN reports, Las Vegas and alcohol probably aren't the first two things that come to mind at the mention of the Christian fundamentalist demon chaser Sarah Palin. But according to Craig Wolf, the president and CEO of the Wine and Liquor Wholesalers of America, he announced today that Sarah Palin will keynote this group's annual convention and expo in Las Vegas in early April. Craig says, quote, Governor Palin is a great supporter of America's free enterprise system and understands that industries like the beverage alcohol industry play a key role in driving our national economy. We're proud and honored to welcome her as a speaker. He added, we expect she will share with the convention attendees her analysis of the current political environment and her vision for America's future, end quote. I'll tell you what, you crazy son of bitches. The convention includes what's billed as a wine and spirits tasting competition. Now, the stop in Las Vegas for the alcoholic beverage group comes a few days before Sarah is scheduled to address the Southern Republican Leadership Conference in New Orleans. Newt will be there, too. I'll bet you Newt will try to get her off in a motel someplace. That's Newt style. What a piece of work this woman is, huh? Presidential material. I think a good idea, get her drunk, dress her as a showgirl, put her on stage, and then see all her GOP friends come running. She's what? She's wearing what? Hot damn! I wonder if she thinks speaking at this convention is God's will. You think? Oh, my God. Promoting alcohol and abstinence. That sounds about right for Sarah. Man. The book Game Changer talks a little bit about, more than a little bit, about Sarah Palin and the fact that she is a complete basket case. There is no question. At one point, as we mentioned last night, the McCain campaign was afraid that she might be mentally unstable. The book recounts one episode on the night of August 31st, 2008, when Sarah Palin arrived in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is according to Annie Shaw at the Mail Online of the UK. She arrived in St. Paul, Minnesota for the Republican convention, and she got a barrage of questions from the media. According to the book, it was then that Steve Schmidt, the Republican campaign chief, McCain's campaign chief, turned to the experts he had recruited and said, quote, "You guys have a lot of work to do. She doesn't know anything," end quote. So they sat her down at a table with a map of the world and gave her a quick history of foreign policy. Over the next few weeks, according to the book, she, quote, crammed furiously, end quote, using index cards for prompts. However, according to the book, her mental state began to falter. The authors write, quote, "She wasn't eating. She wasn't drinking. Maybe half a can of Diet Dr. Pepper a day. No water, ever. She wasn't sleeping." And while being drilled for upcoming interviews, the book says, quote, "She would routinely shut down, chin on her chest, arms folded, eyes cast to the floor, speechless and motionless in what those around her described as a kind of catatonic stupor." And the morning of her interview with Katie Couric on CBS, according to the book, Sarah Palin was unresponsive to attempts to prep her as she was being made up. Her eyes were glassy and dead. And according to the book, quote, "As they were about to set off to meet Katie Couric, Palin announced, 'I hate this makeup,' smearing it off her face, messing up her hair, and complaining that she looked fat," end quote. According to the book, Steve Schmidt, remember he is a campaign chief for McCain, and Rick Davis, or I'm sorry, he was a special advisor, Rick Davis, McCain's campaign manager, the two, Schmidt and Davis, arrived at Palin's hotel room in Philadelphia and, quote, "were appalled by the scene they found. The room was hot and claustrophobic. The place was full of half-eaten hotel food and stank of moldering French fries. Palin looking dazed, was surrounded, as usual, by stacks and stacks of index cards." And according to the book, the camp, the McCain camp was ready to downgrade vice presidential candidate Palin's responsibilities in case of victory to that of a largely ceremonial role. A spokeswoman for Sarah Palin, Meg Stapleton, has dismissed the book's allegations as inaccurate gossip. Oh, man. And then Matt Lauer this morning on NBC's, what is that, the Today Show? I just saw it on Rachel's program. Matt Lauer asked McCain, you know, about this stuff. And McCain refused to answer. He said, "Oh, that's so long ago. I was with the families of three dead American soldiers who were killed in Afghanistan. I don't have time for this." And Matt Lauer persisted and said, "Well, did you know that this was going on?" He said, "I don't know. I don't know anything about this." And Lauer said, "You don't know anything about it. You were running as president. This was to be your vice presidential candidate, and you don't know anything about any of this?" And McCain, with that goofy grin on his face, refused to go any further. It's insane. And the brain-dead Republicans are touting her as a presidential material? Are you goddamn kidding me? Man. Well, anyway. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? Palin. Now, you think Sarah Palin speaking at an alcohol convention in Las Vegas is odd? How about this? Mike Pence, you know, this pig, the one who, I think he's the one that reactivated the death panel's charge about, health insurance reform. Anyway, he's the chair of the House Republican Conference. He said today that Barack Obama, President Obama, had accepted an invitation to address Republican members of Congress at the group's retreat later this month. Pence said in a statement released by his office, quote, House Republicans are grateful that the President of the United States has accepted our invitation to meet with the Republican Conference later this month. House Republicans look forward to presenting the President with our proposals to protect our nation, create jobs, control federal spending, lower the cost of health care, achieve energy independence, and strengthen families, end quote. Now, that conference is slated to meet in Baltimore January 28th through the 30th. President Obama is just determined, isn't he, to continue to reach out to these sarcastic, crazy, sick white people. I don't get it. Bob wrote in about the Harry Reid faux pas as it's being presented by media. You notice that story's gone now. Bob writes, there are 200,000 blacks in Nevada, and Harry has been a mentor to that community and his politicians. He has their full support. This might help in the upcoming election. Same with the 500,000 Latinos. He is a good man, and I'm pleased to see so much strong support from Obama, Eric Holder, and others. Harry will come out fine. This was more about health care than race. Well, yeah. It's more about the sickness of Republican office holders and the mega sickness of rank and file Republicans in this country, so-called conservatives. What a mess, huh? And then I had an email from JL. I guess that would be proper to identify this person. Subject line, agents provocateur. That's the way he has it written. And he's calling about Leonard. Remember the caller Leonard last night? I'll share that with you when we come back after this break. Kind of an interesting, although I disagree with what JL wrote, but and I'll tell you why. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
This really might be our demise, this pack of lies. Instead of mailing, just because you're good at shooting doesn't mean you have the ammo to negotiate with Putin. Are you on coke? This country's up in smoke. Oh, what a joke.
Oh, if you become the EO, what will it mean for me? Oh, if you become the
just because I can see the moon doesn't make me an astronaut, you loon. Your foreign policy expertise is poo.
Renegade Talk Radio done right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. Before we get to this letter from JL, Prairie 2 writes in, our economic affairs correspondent. He writes regarding the trade deficit, the U.S. trade deficit is up sharply despite the weak U.S. dollar, which should be driving exports. But since we don't make anything, we are just selling our natural resources cheaper, and this drives the trade deficit up instead of down. Alcoa Aluminum posted a worse-than-expected quarter due to the continuing disintegration of this American industry, while China's imports of mineral ore and other raw materials are up sharply. Germany had been the world's biggest exporter, shipping at twice the rate of China, but has slipped to second place. This comes from a weak dollar as well as from the worldwide recession. China has been cracking down on U.S. banks that have been trying to do the same nonsense there that is considered good business in the U.S. Rumor is that U.S. banks are being forced to repay huge sums of money gouged from state-owned companies that bought derivatives that went bad. The Chinese are making them do this. China is trying to avoid a real estate bubble by increasing capital requirements on their banks and increasing the down payment needed by borrowers. Rated by the value of their assets to their liabilities, China has five of the six healthiest banks in the world, and number five of that group is located in Brazil. Being a banker in China is a good job, but doesn't pay what it does in the U.S. Bankers in China don't have the same opportunities as Wall Street bankers, since corruption in China can carry the death penalty, unlike here, where it carries a huge bonus. PrairieNumeral2.com is his website. Wow. From JL, Mike, the caller last night who said he had an autistic child and said he wasn't being properly served by the Democratic Party and was turning to the Republican Party to find his big payoff. I believe his name was Leonard. I think you were had. Are you aware of the professional callers that are now infiltrating the progressive radio talk show call-in lines? Their modus operandi is to ingratiate themselves with the show hosts, getting you to trust them using sympathy, or they use common sense populism to describe their own open-minded approach to life situations or beliefs. And they try to converse like they are the best friend of your long-lost brother. All this is targeted as a big, fat plug for the Republicans or conservative ideology. Ever since I heard this was a new tactic of the right, I've heard periodically these people call into various shows. I think a caller after him responded to him saying he should have known everything he was complaining about had existed and that the benefits of the GI Bill are not the same as they were after World War II. Anyway, I don't know how you can screen the calls for these people, but good luck. I know what you're talking about. I've heard the same thing from through the grapevine, but I don't think Leonard. As a matter of fact, our good friend Kate in the desert, who's on her way down to do more relief work in Mississippi, sent me an email and said she recognizes who Leonard is. And in this particular case, JL, I think Leonard was speaking from the heart. But I appreciate your suspicions. I really do. Right-wingers will do anything. Republican rank and file, they are charged to destroy the country, and that's what they're trying to do. But I don't think that's what Leonard was. And then, of course, you heard today about the assassination of the Iranian scientists. According to a U.S. intelligence official, they immediately released by mid-afternoon, the CIA released a statement saying it played no role, none, in the bombing that killed the university scientists on, today. Iranian officials and state media described Professor Masoud Ali Mohammadi as a nuclear scientist. And Iran's cabinet said agents of the United States and Israel were behind his murder. The U.S. intelligence official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said, quote, any suggestion that the CIA played a role here is flat wrong, end quote. And a U.S. State Department official earlier rejected as, quote, absurd, end quote, to Iran's accusations of U.S. involvement. Well, okay, what is to be expected? That the CIA and the Mossad will come out and say, yeah, we got the bastard? No. Or some of those Blackwater people that we have skulking around Iran and Pakistan and India and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and they're going to leap up out of the woodwork and say, ha ha, we got another one. No, I don't think so. But anyway, there's your official denial. And of course, the official denial had to come. For the CIA to deny anything, the best thing for the CIA to do, of course, is just to keep their goddamn mouths shut, right? I mean, the CIA has a 70-year-long history of being the most sophisticated terrorist organization on Earth, where it concerns murder, mayhem, overthrowing governments, destabilizing countries, ruining currencies, plotting rumors, engineering assassinations, if not doing them themselves. Come on, come on. The CIA now operates the Predator drones that are blasting school children and civilians into red mist in Afghanistan. And the CIA jumps up like a jack-in-the-box today and says, no, no, we had nothing to do with that one. Oh, okay. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. Rachel Maddow will join us in about half an hour. At TPM Muckraker today, Justin Elliott was writing about the Christmas bomber underpants, 23-year-old Nigerian yada yada, the bogus flight 253 one-way ticket meme. And Justin writes, it's, you know, the anatomy of a myth. And, of course, I bought into this immediately because the only information I had, we were away, obviously, that entire week. And I bought the meme that Abdulmutallab's one-way ticket was part of the evidence that he planned to come over here and do some damage. Justin writes, it's in a remarkable example of how bad information can travel far and wide. Dozens of media outlets around the world have said that Abdulmutallab was traveling on a one-way ticket to Detroit when he allegedly tried to blow up Flight 253, even though that has never been substantiated and appears to be flat wrong. This one-way ticket meme has been cited in by the AP, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, even though the Nigerian government said 3 days later that Abdulmutallab had a round-trip ticket and provided details to back it up. The one-way ticket meme was originally sourced to anonymous U.S. officials and has since been recited as an undisputed fact. Well, yeah, it has, hasn't it? It has been referenced repeatedly by commentators attacking the U.S. government for missing red flags about Abdulmutallab. And I certainly was one of those people who said, you know, how in the world somebody buys a one-way ticket, no luggage, pays cash, gets walked past standard security and put on a flight, and then the intelligence agencies in this country say, oh, well, we didn't connect the dots. I still think the intelligence agencies in this country are riddled with with Bush Cheney killers. But anyway, in a typical case, on December 28th, when the accurate information was already available, CNN anchor Erica Hill asked, quote, "So, just how did a guy on a terror watch list with a one-way ticket paid for in cash with no luggage manage to board a U.S. airliner and allegedly try to blow it to pieces? Simply put, who screwed up?" End quote. And here's the pig man on Friday after this. Quote, "When a 20-something Muslim male buys a one-way ticket with cash and has no luggage, that's not a dot. That's a fire alarm. He may as well have said, he may as well have I'm a terrorist tape on his T-shirt," end quote. But reports published on December 28th cited the conclusion of the Nigerian government that Abdul Muttalib had a round-trip ticket to Detroit. It had been purchased in Ghana on December 16th for $2,831, according to the Associated Press. His return date was found by the Nigerians to be January 8th. A Dutch government report described by the International Herald Tribune on December 31st also said Abdul Muttalib had a round-trip ticket. But it's not clear whether the Dutch were simply relying on the Nigerians' conclusions. The New York Times published a correction on December 30th, saying it had erroneously reported Abdul Muttalib's ticket was one-way. And so many of the outlets that mentioned the one-way ticket haven't run corrections. So where did this false meme come from? It came from anonymous U.S. government sources. The first citation of a one-way ticket that TPN Muckraker could find was a report on Christmas Day by MSNBC. And the report said, quote, "Federal officials identified the man as Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalib, 23, of Nigeria, who was traveling one way without a return ticket," end quote. And then December 26th edition of New York Daily News said, quote, "Officials said Abdul Muttalib was traveling one way without a return ticket." NBC's Pete Williams told TPM Muckraker, quote, "Though there were federal officials who initially said it was one way, we've been saying since that it was round trip, which it clearly was," end quote. But there's a whole lot of media consumers out here, and I certainly was one of them, who believe the initial story that Abdul Muttalib came to Detroit on a one-way ticket. That phrase had been cited by CNN, Fox, Time, Newsweek, Associated Press, Washington Post, New York Times, Boston Globe, Gannett News Service, Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Sacramento Bee, the Globe and Mail of the UK, the Washington Times, Congressional Quarterly, and many other. Isn't it amazing how easy it is, isn't it? It is so easy to get this stuff out there. Now, I don't make any claim that this program is a news show. On the other hand, my relying on standard media for certain stories that find its way on this program is probably a big mistake. Probably. Today's show, show's Matt Lauer even asked about the one-way ticket in a question to Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano, who didn't address the matter in her answer. The only substantiated reference to a one-way ticket that TPM Muckraker could find is a statement by a Ghanaian official last week that Abdul Muttalib purchased a one-way ticket in cash from Accra, Ghana to Lagos, Nigeria. From Ghana to Nigeria. Now, that was in addition to the purchase of the ticket from Lagos to Detroit via Amsterdam and return. The Wall Street Journal says Abdul Muttalib took Virgin Nigeria Flight 804 from Accra to Lagos on December 24th before getting on a plane en route to Amsterdam. And there are few signs, of course, that the one-way meme is going to die anytime soon. I cite that lengthy report by TPM Muckraker, Justin Elliott, who wrote that for TPM Muckraker, as just another example of how there's no way to believe American media. Glenn Greenwald, as a matter of fact, writing today at Salon.com, talks about the fundamental unreliability of America's media. Oh, he mentions the same story and some more. But what does it say about a country where we can't even rely on media to get the truth? Of course, when you have something like right-wing talk radio, from which so many brain-dead right-wingers and Republicans get all the information they think they need, when you have that as a force in this society, and then you have something as willfully willing to commit falsehoods and outright lies as Fox News, where millions more get their news, and then you have erroneous reporting by the non-Fox networks and so many in the print medium. Where are we supposed to go to get the truth if we're not informed? If we don't have the truth, and the truth is not relative, the truth is the truth. There's not two sides to the truth. There's not the real side and the Fox News side. There's not the real side and the Glenn Beck side. So where to go? What do you do? There are a lot of websites where the truth can be found. They are not so-called mainstream media. Hopefully someday they will be. But anyway, I just hate that. Don't you? We can't trust the organizations that have FCC licenses that are supposed to do something to keep us informed, and we can't trust them.
Because liberal is a good word. It's more Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. I've gotten a couple more emails here on Leonard, the caller from Arizona last night. This is from Raging Lefty, who writes, Mike, I remember Leonard, too. He is not a right-wing tool. When Leonard called you yesterday, he said he was asking for help from the Republican congressman, because the Democratic congressman, if there are any in Arizona, was not helping him. He didn't say he was joining the Republican Party. Leonard is a brave man. In 2005, I called my Senator Dayton to help him after he was arrested. Leonard was arrested in Iraq for speaking out against the war. And then Raging Lefty includes what she posted at Democratic Underground way back in July of 2005. And here's what it says. An Arizona Army National Guardsman whose weblog comments have criticized the Iraq War and who has filed papers to run for the U.S. Senate seat held by John Kyle is the subject of a military investigation in Iraq, the Army said Tuesday. What exactly Leonard Clark is being investigated for is unclear. Clark, 40, of Glendale, Arizona, is a kindergarten teacher, activist, and perennial candidate for public office. He holds the rank of specialist in Arizona's 860th Military Police Company. Army Captain Patricia Brewer, a spokesman with the military's Combined Press Information Office in Baghdad, said, quote, Specialist Clark is under investigation, but he's not under arrest. She said no other details were available regarding Clark. From the 42nd Military Police Brigade's Judge Advocate General's office, and this was in the website of Arizona AZCentral.com, which I believe is the Isn't that the Arizona Republic? Yeah, their newspaper. Big newspaper there. So anyway, thanks to everybody who has written about Leonard. If it was the same guy, yeah, I vaguely remember that story too from 5 years ago when he was being investigated by the Army because he was an advocate that we should get the hell out of Iraq. Bruce writes, regarding the one-way ticket meme, it seemed to me that everybody had that one-way ticket meme right away. Did they give a timeline for the spread of the disinformation? I would guess that some lower-level Bush crime family embed took the opportunity to call a press conference while everybody else was off for Christmas and spoke off the record, making it all as juicy as possible. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised either. I would not be the least bit surprised. That's the way these bastards work. That's the way they work. Well, anyway. What else we got here? We got a call from Rachel's producer. She may have to spend a very short amount of time with us because this MSNBC may bring her back on live because of the earthquake in Haiti. So we'll see. If she has to, you know, she's a star. If she has to go, she has to go. And I got this email from Kay. Mike, my stepdad forwarded this article from The Guardian of the UK to me, and I wanted to pass it on. Isn't this what you've been saying for years? Bankers produce nothing. Maybe I missed it, but I don't recall seeing this in the New York Times. And according to The Guardian of the UK, their article, cleaners worth more to society than bankers, says the think tank. And what this is all about, child care workers create seven British pounds for every £1 they are paid, while bankers destroy £7 of value for every $1 or £1 they earn. Hospital cleaners are worth more to society than city bankers, according to a report that shows many low-paid workers increase the well-being of the nation more than the high-flying and much better-paid financial sector staff. And it goes on, the report said tax accountants were the most destructive, laying waste to £47 of value for every £1 they created. Elite bankers destroy £7 of value for every £1 they create, and advertising executives wreck £11 of value for every $1 they are paid. Oh, my God. The study goes even further than asking whether high wages are justified. Investment bankers create value from the economic activity they facilitate, an increase in jobs and wholesale banking and tax contributions. But these are offset by the cost of the current crisis and the negative impact on the public finances. It goes on. But, you know, once again, it doesn't it show this article and the research that goes into an article like this, it shows the relative unworth of the top tier of people who are now running the capitalistic system in this country. We're not talking about John Rockefeller or Andrew Carnegie, you know, some of the big oligarch titans of corporate America from a century ago. Nuh-uh. We're talking about people like Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, who creates nothing and yet is able to pay his executives billions.
Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
Welcome back. It's about 25 before the hour. Rachel's on the phone. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Mike Malloy. I'm so happy to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to talk to you. We haven't chatted since, oh my God, I think it was Seattle right before you got the gig with MSNBC. How are you doing?
I am surprisingly okay. Although, you can probably hear the printer running behind me. We've had a big shakeup here at MSNBC tonight. That's a horrible pun to use by accident. But in covering the breaking news out of Haiti, I'm going to be live for the second for what usually is the replay of my show during an hour of breaking news on the earthquake situation there. Which the more we learn about it, the more horrible it is. So that's.
Yeah, that's what Kathy said. I realize we don't have a lot of time. My daughter, Libby, who is your number one fan, sent me an email and said, why can't Keith cover the earthquake?
Tell her to call Keith, not me.
Right, exactly. I don't know where to start. I don't have a whole lot of stuff to get into with you. I have to say that your program gets a tremendous amount of positive comment here on the Malloy Show. People, I borrow and steal from you all the time, and from Oberman. I just think that you're doing a tremendous job. I love your program. I think you have one of the, if not the best program, and don't say anything, on television. It's a great show, and congratulations on doing what you're doing. They must give you a certain amount of freedom to do the subjects and the topics and the interviews that you do, right?
Yeah, it's been a surprise to me too, but I sort of made clear very early on when I first started talking with them about doing a show that it was only valuable to me if I had editorial control, and it just hasn't been an issue. They've let me do what I want, even, when I want to do a whole hour on Afghanistan or I want to cover Uganda 20 days in a row. They've been okay with it. So I'm hoping that I've established that ground rule and that's the way it's going to be. I don't think this would be a job worth doing if you couldn't say what you wanted to say.
Yeah, that's true. And to have editorial control of your program, when you and I both worked at Air America, I think that was one of the things that we stipulated even back then.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to do what you do without any kind of, within reason. I mean, you have to stay within the boundaries of broadcast standards and practices, but to be able to do the kind of program that you choose to do is so necessary. This book, Game Change, in the short amount of time we have, is this not a mind scrambler or what?
I resist personal information about public figures and news. Like, I resist that. It's not the thing that I'm into. On the other hand, when we have at least reportedly intimate information about the way these decisions went down, and they're so much worse than we ever knew before.
Oh, my God.
It's really, it is valuable to know that John McCain did not care that Sarah Palin didn't know why there was a North and South Korea.
Yeah, Matt Lauer's interview with him this morning, where McCain just said, I don't care about the selection process, how they came up with Sarah Palin. That's at the very best spin on that. That is an extremely cavalier attitude on the part of McCain to pick someone to be the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency, whose selection he didn't care about.
He's a 72-year-old cancer survivor picking a vice presidential nominee. He's the only person who gets to pick her. Nobody gets to vote on her in a standalone way. He picked her for the country without bothering to figure out why she didn't know what the Fed was.
Yeah. here's another one for you. Did you ever, in your wildest imagination, think that Ted Olson and David Boies would be working the same side of the street?
I know. And it was apparently initiated by Olson. Olson is the one who called David Boies and said, hey, do you want to work on this case with me?
That surprises me. I got put off about Ted Olson a long time ago when I believe he was Solicitor General at one time, right?
Yeah, during the first Bush term. He was the whole post-9/11. Everything.
Right. And
he was even the keep under God in the Pledge of Allegiance Solicitor General.
Right. So how does this guy come down on the side of civil rights in California fighting against this Prop 8? I don't quite get this. Do you, what's your insight
That's
on?
That's why I wanted, I had him on the show tonight and that was my first question. I was like, yeah, I understand your legal arguments and everything, but what's up, man? Like, why did you come to this?
Right.
And he made a very sober, lawyerly argument about how he thinks it's the right thing to do. I still don't have personal insight into where it came from, but I will tell you that it's the cover story in Newsweek. It's the conservative case for gay marriage. It's not written about Ted Olson. It's written by him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is the definitive argument on same-sex marriage. And the fact that it's written by a conservative sort of political icing, but it's he destroys the case against gay marriage being legalized, absolutely destroys it. I feel like it's a total game changer how good that argument is. And I've not been a fan of the stances that he's taken over his political career, but boy, he's a guy who's nice to have on the right side of things if you feel like this is where he should
I wonder
go.
Why he would be so dedicated to this particular case when his stance on human rights in general or just that whole right wing agenda seems to be very counterintuitive that Ted Olson would get involved like this. I just wonder what is in his heart about this.
And I asked and didn't get insight. I mean, I got an argument and not an expression. But there's definitely, I mean, when he first said that he was going to do this, people were so suspicious of his motives that they thought maybe he's bringing this up as a federal court case because he knows if it goes to the Supreme Court, it'll get definitively banned. He's doing a reverse here.
Exactly.
I don't think that's it.
Well, I will see your interview with him after midnight tonight. I record your program because, you know, you come on during my first hour.
Yeah.
It's all I can do to watch Keith interview or hand it off to you. And then I've got to go live. Is the health insurance reform idea, is it dead?
No, I don't think it's dead.
What's keeping it alive?
I think that the Democrats will pass something and call it reform.
Okay.
So, I mean, is the dream of health reform dead? No. Is the dream of health reform wounded? Yes. But I do think that the Democrats politically have to pass something and call it reform and declare victory, and it better happen before the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't go this far and then not cross the finish line. Something will pass, and then it's going to be a matter of people taking policy seriously and prioritizing policy over just partisan politics. Not the sense that we all need to get along, but in the sense that people need to worry about something other than elections. They need to worry about that legislation getting better over time after it passes initially, or we're going to have something that's called reform that is.
So I've gotten to the point, let me preface it by saying I've gotten to the point where I guess I've become so cynical about how that debate, so-called, wound around the country last summer and how it's been attacked by members of Congress, Republicans and then Democrats, that I've just pretty much given up hope that any kind of a consequential or substantial health insurance reform can ever come to pass. You still hold out the hope.
I do. And I think that to the extent that the federal government is going to take responsibility for whether or not people have health coverage, if the federal government takes responsibility, that is a change in the relationship of people in government. And this is, I think, where the Tea Partiers are right to be freaked out about it, because they are right. That is the government, for the first time ever, taking responsibility for people at large, not just specific groups of Americans, being covered. And that is a new floor from which you build up. And that it is, I think it is an ideological advance in terms of what the social contract is in this country.
I hope you're right. And that these dark thoughts I have will fly away and go someplace.
Your dark thoughts. We all love you for your dark thoughts.
Were the suits at NBC prepared for your success, do you think?
I think the suits at NBC felt like they stumbled upon me, and then, of course, once you succeed, everybody takes credit for having discovered you. But it was Keith Olbermann who discovered me. I mean, Keith asked me to be a guest host on his show when nobody had any idea why he was doing that or thought that I could do it, and I got sort of surprisingly good ratings when I did that. And once they saw numbers, and then Keith very kindly went on vacation for 2 weeks last summer and left me in control of his show, and the numbers held, it was just a matter of them just pulling the trigger, but it really was Keith. And anybody else who takes credit for it I am flattered, but it's not true.
Well, the camera loves you. There are people who get onto television who may be very talented, But they don't have, I guess in the industry they call it the Q factor. They don't have that Q factor. You have both. You've got that amazing ability to make things that normally would be incoherent, very coherent. And that's difficult to do with the camera on you unless the camera likes you. And you have both. I swear to God you do. It's just amazing. I remember when you subbed for Obermann, and you know, I was kind of surprised because, you know, you and I have spent a little time together out on the talk radio circuit and sure. had breakfast with your parents and stuff like that, who I'm sure they're very proud of you. But to see you step into the role that you've now stepped into and the way you've built that program, good Lord, Rachel, you are doing an excellent job. That's all. I just had to say that. I'm not, you know, I believe a hero ain't nothing but a sandwich, but you're one of mine.
You're incredibly kind. Thank you.
All right, listen.
I'm happy to be on the show. Thanks.
Back to it. I hope the stories out of Haiti aren't too horrifying. Thanks for taking a moment out to talk with us,
Appreciate
Rachel.
Appreciate it, Mike. Great to talk.
All right, take care. Take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. Regarding the crazy right-winger named David, who wrote at the beginning of the program, Nikki in Madison, Wisconsin writes, Mike, I just want to make a comment on the email you read on your show from a David who essentially accused atheists of not helping in Haiti. As a non-believer myself, I'd like David to know that I've done a lot of community work, even back when I was a teenager, without any religious guidance. I even worked with my father, who is a profound atheist, when he led an effort to get supplies down to residents after a hurricane. David should know that non-believers do care about other people. We just don't believe a God caused the problem. Also, David, being such a good Christian, of course, knows that the Bible clearly states that God does not want people to judge others, as David just did, but that all judging will come from God only. I guess he needs to get back to the books. Nikki and Madison. And regarding my comment about the Iranian scientists who was probably, or I probably said something to the effect of absolutely, killed by a combination of CIA and Mossad work. I get this email, Mike. I'm usually on board with what you say regarding the actions of the CIA, Mossad, and other black op agencies where assassinations and wet work is concerned. But as an Iranian American who is pretty well informed about what's going on inside Iran right now, I'm going to have to take issue with your belief that the CIA and or Mossad took this person out due to the nuclear program. I believe, and as a matter of fact, if any Iranian within or outside of Iran is asked this question, the majority would believe that Dr. Mohammadi's death was orchestrated and carried out by the government itself as retribution for his support for the reform movement and his speaking up about the matter in public, as well as a continuing trend of operations carried out by the regime in the last 7 months in order to silence the opposition through violence and terror. An example of which have been the killings by the Basij against police against protesters, the most recent one being that of Mousavi's own nephew. So, yeah, Mike, even though we have our spooks and ghouls on this side, don't forget that the regime in Iran has their own haints tearing the innocent apart as well. Sam in Los Angeles. Thanks, Sam. Yeah, I certainly accept that explanation, too. The religious regime that runs Iran is not, in the opinion of exile or, you know, not banished, but exiled by themselves to this country, emigrants from Iran. I would suggest the term exile might be appropriate. But from what I've been able to hear, that the government of Iran is certainly on the verge of is being challenged. I mean, you can see these YouTube videos or these phone videos. Oh my God! That's why I wish the United States would adopt a more conciliatory attitude. We've talked about this before so many times on this program. The way to bring about a revolution against a repressive government, except in this country, we just don't do it here because I guess we don't have the time, huh? But the way to do it is to encourage the middle class, the educated class, the professionals who are being oppressed and whose political beliefs are being suppressed by a very fearful government regime, such as the one in Iran. Because that's where revolution comes, where it comes from, is from an educated middle class. It doesn't come from people who are struggling for existence, who are illiterate, who are uneducated, who don't have an historical sense, not of their own doing, not because they choose to be that way, but because in so many of these countries, United States included, an effort is made, a very serious effort, to keep people uneducated and poor. Much easier to control people when they're in that state. So, thanks, Sam. Mark is in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, I've been thinking a lot, Mike, about the destruction the Republican Party's done to this country. And basically, it's to the point now where if you vote Republican, you're voting to empower al-Qaeda for all they've done, the recruiting they've done, the killing they've done, destroying the economy, the military. You look at the destruction of the Republican Party to this country, and you can make a case that Osama bin Laden is giving them the marching orders. That's how bad it is.
Do you want to elaborate on that? What do you mean, giving them the marching orders?
Well, I mean, Bush and Cheney starting the wars in Iraq and Iran has been a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. Everything they've done is basically empowered al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
Destroying this country, the military. I mean, I know it's an extreme view, but I mean, to me, if you vote Republican, you're voting to destroy this country.
Right, right. No, I agree with that. But the Obama part, I'm not sure.
Not Obama. I mean, Osama bin Laden.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden. That's what I know that's an extreme view, but the Republicans are basically carrying out what he would want done to this country. And you know, I mean, mm-hmm. That's an extreme view, but I can't see it any other way. I could never vote Republican. Never.
No, I could. No, obviously. I don't think anyone with any rational grasp of sanity could ever vote Republican. All right, Mark, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say, okay?
Okay, buddy.
All right, sir. Take care. All right, we have a break here. When we come back, we're going to take your phone calls for the rest of the program. So we have a couple open lines here. The number is 877-996-2556. I'd like to hear what you got to say tonight. Stay with us. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. The phone number here is 877-996-2556 if you'd like to join in the fun of frivolity. Perez is in Santa Rosa, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Perez.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure.
You know, I used to think the Moody Blues, what's that?
Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't say
it. I got a little echo here on my end.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I think that's got it. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I was going to say, I used to think the Moody Blues were kind of dorky. I'm an old R&B guy, but man, they sound pretty damn good, don't they?
I got hung up on them some time ago and just never got rid of that part of, you know, I like REO Speedwagon. So I go for the classics. Yeah, you know, the jazz classics. I can listen to Brubeck, Thelonious Monk. I mean, just go right down the list. But there's some rock and roll or some of this spacey music that I still like. Pink Floyd, I will always, always, always enjoy Pink Floyd. I've already got like four numbers picked for my memorial service after I'm dead.
Okay. You know, there's a great article about Thelonious Monk. And the Nation magazine just came out. It's wonderful. A lot of things I never knew about the guy.
I just got, I think I just got a copy today or yesterday. I haven't read it yet, but okay. I will get to it,
Yeah. But I wanted to talk about the news a little bit. You're talking about the one-way ticket, brouhaha and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, and I mainly want to focus on the Supreme Court case that was decided. Apparently went all the way up to those guys, the Supremes and their little robes. About the two reporters that refused to lie for Fox News, even though they kept dumbing down their story over and over and over again, they still got shafted. And they were told basically by the Supreme Court that you can be ordered to lie or lose your job. And I think a lot of these media outlets watched that case. And a lot of people might not have heard about it. But
well, just so people know, it was a case in Central Florida. It was several years ago now, but the ruling by the Florida Supreme Court was just these reporters could be forced to lie by Fox, and if they didn't, Fox reserved the right to fire them. And
I wanted to extrapolate from that a little bit. You were talking about who can you trust? Well, I think that's it's a brilliant plan. I'm telling you, these guys are evil, Mike. They're evil. Just in case we didn't know.
Yeah.
These people that are running these things are evil. Here's what's going to happen, and it's already started to happen. You can see it happening. They want it to be where people can automatically say you can't believe anything you hear.
Mm-hmm.
So that means the good stuff out there will be disbelieved as well.
Right.
That is really what they're going for. They're people just throw up their hands, listen to what makes you feel good and reinforces your mistakes, your beliefs, mm-hmm. which, as everybody knows, beliefs can be are persuaded to believe, but you can't be persuaded to knowledge. And these people say they know something. They really mean they believe something. And I think that there's one way to solve this. If we hit the FCC, it'll be like civil versus criminal law. Okay, we lost in this criminal court. The good guys lost on the criminal side. But the FCC can still revoke their license and say that lying to the public is not in the public interest.
Wouldn't that be be a remarkable ruling?
But I was thinking about that, and and it just makes you want to throw up your hands. But I believe that there's 15-20% of the people in this country. There's no point in even stopping to talk to them because they ain't going to listen. And like Reagan said, I believe facts are silly things.
Yeah, they are. I think your number should be higher, though. I don't think it's 15 to 20%. I think it's more like 45 to 50%. Or even
higher. The dark thoughts, like Rachel said, buddy, we love them all. And how's the book coming along?
Still working on it. It essentially has been written. It just has to be assembled.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to it, Mike.
Me too. All right.
And the next time I call, I'm going to try to set it up to where I can read a few verses of atheist poetry, which I...
Okay. Well, you get that past Kathy, and I'll put you on.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right. Take care. Take care. Atheist poetry. All right. John is in Cincinnati listening on XM. Hey, John.
Hey, Mike. I always enjoy your program.
Thank you, sir.
War itself is just a continuation of politics by other means.
Right.
It's a political solution. the Americans and the Israelis need to sit down with the Iranians and let them understand that we're going to try to find a political solution short of war. But let them understand that war is a solution that may have to be explored. I believe the Israelis are going to attack within the month.
You do?
Yes.
That soon?
I look at it this way. I tell my Israeli neighbor, my Jewish neighbor, he's a peacenik. I'll tell you something, buddy. They talk about these so-called moderate Arab countries. The reason why they're moderate is because they fought five wars with Israel, got the hell kicked out of them five times. It's not because there's Arabs in those countries all of a sudden like you as a Jew. They fear you. Big difference, pal. And what they need to do with the Iranians is they're going to have to fear them. That's what's going to happen.
You kind of lost me here. What I'm not sure what position you're taking at all, John.
I don't want to see war, but it may come to that. I think the Israelis are going to attack within the month.
Well, why do you think the Iranians, the Israelis should attack Iran? Israel is the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons.
Right, and it needs to stay that way.
Why?
Considering the fact that their neighbors go to bed every night and dream about the day that land is theirs again. See, what the Americans, I agree with you, Mike, what the Americans got to do is they got to quit BS in the Arab world. And because I tell my other right-wing neighbor on the other side of me, I said, look, it wouldn't matter if Israel was a dictatorship. You would support them because you believe they're God's chosen people. If you want to politically commit suicide in the United States, turn your back on Israel. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, you will be voted out of office so fast and make your head swim.
I would like to see American political power... This will never happen, ever. It's just a dream of mine. See, American political power applied to Israel to disarm their nuclear weapons, and this would be step two. Step one would be for the United States to begin unilateral nuclear disarmament.
I agree with you, Mike. But you know what? I was in the Marine Corps for many years, and my daddy was in the Marines as well. And he said, you know, I always laugh about these weapons of mass destruction, son. The real weapons of mass destruction with killing our troops in Iraq are the two most devastating weapon systems ever created by man. Machine guns and artillery weapons and bombs. Those have killed almost 70 million human beings in the last 120 years.
Mm-hmm.
How many people have been killed by nuclear weapons? 300,000?
Well, let's remember, they've only been used twice.
Right. That's not the concern.
All right.
Mutual destruction there.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, John. I really do. I wish there was a solution to the problems in the Middle East. You come across as kind of a warmonger, but I think your real interest is seeing all this nonsense stop and that some solution, some magical thing happen where Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs and Palestinian Christians and Arabs and everybody could just sit down and work things out. I was talking to somebody about this. Thanks, Jen. I was talking to somebody about this today who said, asked me if I had any hope or if I was hopeless. And I said, well, I have hope that something will occur. We don't have that something yet. Maybe it'll be like finding a way to convert water into endless energy. Maybe that would calm the world down and stop the wars. Maybe it'd be a way to prove once and for all that religion is a phony construct and has been killing people for millennia. Something that we don't have now would manifest and would kind of bring us together. But short of that, I don't really have any hope that things are going to be worked out. It's going to take something super extra special to do it, if it's doable. Adidas, Lacoste, cheaper brands, Cadillac, Amtrak, gasoline, diesel, a standard of living. Could this be the reason that we would choose to kill a child? Kill.
Hey, truth seekers. Here's the truth speaker, Mike Malloy.
And a flag upon your car, and a ribbon on your mailbox, with the stars and bars. Do you support the president and the war for oil? Do you think your sons belong there on someone else's soil?
Twenty-one past the hour. Phone number here is 877-996-2556. So join us. Andy is in Toledo, Ohio, listening online. Hey, Andy.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to move over to the window to get a little bit of reception. This is the first time I've called in, and you know, I've been listening to you a long time as Jim Young Get the Podcast, and thanks for that. I've learned a lot from your show. And I just had this idea this morning. I was thinking about the constitutionality of the filibuster.
Of the what?
And filibuster.
Oh, the filibuster, okay.
Because there's no language constitution for the filibuster. And I can appreciate that Congress, the Senate, can make its own laws. But how can they make a rule that is not in the Constitution? And I appreciate that this is maybe not something you typically discuss on your show. Almost like a Tom Hartman kind of thing. But how would somebody be able to address or maybe challenge, in your opinion, the Senate's ability to create something that's really outside of the Constitution? And could someone like me try to challenge that authority?
Well, I think the way it's set up, the Senate has a right to make its own rules. And insofar as not instituting a rule that would be specifically unconstitutional. Now, I don't know if the filibuster rule has ever been challenged in court or ruled on by the Supreme Court. I think it would possibly take someone within the Senate itself to challenge this. The Senate is charged by the Constitution with a role of advice and consent to the president, and how they reach that is the Senate has declared that's their business. As long as they're not saying things like, "Well, if a female senator is elected, or if a woman is elected to be a senator, we won't count her vote because she's a woman," or if a so-called minority. You know, that would be unconstitutional. But as far as making rules within the Senate itself about how they pass laws, I don't know if...
Or count votes.
If what?
Or count the votes.
Yeah.
Closure.
And I think you are right. I think that's a Tom Hartman question.
Yes.
If you do call Tom and ask him... Call me back and let me know what he said, because I don't have a clue.
I'm literally, sitting in my car driving my daughter to school this morning, thinking, oh, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? And this is not in the Constitution. And why did they make this artificial rule?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's time for someone to challenge it. And really, why should I be coming to that conclusion sitting in Toledo, Ohio? Somebody would have come to that conclusion at the age.
Right. Well, that's the thing. If it were literally unconstitutional, I think it would have been challenged at this point.
Right.
I think you can make a strong argument that it is contrary to what Senate rules have always been, and what the theories of this republic are all about, that majority rules with respect to the rights of the minority. But when it comes to passing laws, I don't know. Again, I hope you ask Hartman. I hope he gives you an answer. How long have you lived in Toledo?
I've lived here for about a year and a half.
Oh.
In Ottawa Hills.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's a nice neighborhood. I grew up in Toledo. I went to school there. high school, elementary school, and even a little bit at University of Toledo before I left. But that's my hometown. So
yeah, it's a nice place.
Is it? Do you have a job?
Yes, I do.
Well, good.
I'm gainfully employed, yes.
Well, good, because Toledo, you know, when I was a kid, when I lived there, Toledo was this booming feeder city for Detroit. But in the 70s, it started to die, and especially the downtown section. And I haven't been there for a while. Last time I was there was for a funeral. But
it's pretty beat down. I actually moved out here for my wife's job.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rough time for Toledo. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, Andy.
Keep us up to date on the book. I'm looking forward to getting
it. All right, we'll do. We'll do. Thanks for checking in. Let me know what Hartman says. All right, we got to go. We got a break. We'll be back. Stay with us if you're online. We have one open line, 877-996-25. Well, never mind. There it goes. We'll be right back.
You know that here comes hell. Barely getting by with millions in profits. It's just another lie. Hey, don't it make you rich, stay? Hey, don't it make you rich, stay? Hey, don't it make you rich, stay blue?
Right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
Okay. 25 before the hour. Jim is in Riverside, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Jim.
Mike, I'm just an I'm a subscriber. I'm far away from LA, so I don't get that station on my AM radio.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just taking issue with the guy who mentioned about the Israel, you know, attacking the Iran in a few months,
mm-hmm.
and the Arabs hating the Jews. I'm a Palestinian refugee. I was born in Jordan. My family originally from Palestine, you know, they were driven from mm-hmm. Palestine to make room for the European Jews.
Right.
This struggle between Arabs and Israelis, it's about land, Mike. It's not about religion. So I hate it when people say the Arabs hate the Jews. We got no problem with the Jewish people. Absolutely none whatsoever. The Jews have lived there peacefully, and the Christians and the Muslims
mm-hmm.
coexisted peacefully in Spain and in the Middle East for a very long, long time.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, Mike, there are 25,000 Jews living in Iran right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wish people would stop equating the Jews with Israel also, because not all Jews support Israel.
That's...
And if the Arabs are fighting Israel, they're not fighting the Jews. And it's all about land, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I completely agree. I completely agree, Jim. The religion, the Jewishness of Israel enters into it in that Israel is a Jewish state. In other words, it is a state whose constitution recognized Judaism as its founding principle. So based on that, based on the Israeli constitution, it is a religious state in the same way that Iran,
Arabia, you know, Mike, I share many of your views, you know, I'm a non-practicing Muslim, I'm Muslim by name only.
Mm-hmm.
So I share a lot of views, you know, I listen to you every night, and, you could say I'm a borderline atheist, if there's such a thing. But yes, in the Middle East, they are, religious there, and, you know, many governments, their constitution, their laws are based on religion, but so is Israel, and so are our Republican Party, for mm-hmm. that matter. You know, so we've got the Christian Taliban, the Muslim Taliban, and the Jewish Taliban as well.
That's true. That's very true. But I agree with you that it is an issue of territory. It is an issue of land, with the subtext being the belief of the Jews that this is land given to them by their God, and that anyone else who lives there are illegal residents and have to go. And again, I get that not from my own observation or my own interpretation, but I've said before on this program, during the first Intifada, I had occasion to interview Rabbi Meir Kahana before he was assassinated in New York. And it was when he wrote the book, They Must Go, which I'm sure you're familiar with. It was a book that was just way over the top, talking about how the Palestinian Arab had to leave because the Jew was coming from Kiev and Brooklyn and Buenos Aires and Johannesburg, and they were coming, and in order to make room.
That's the Zionist idea, you know,
right.
European Jews. And those European Jews, believe me, they killed Middle Eastern Jews when they were established in Israel. They committed terrorist acts against them in Morocco and Algeria in order for them to immigrate to Israel, leave the Arab world and immigrate to Israel because they want to populate it with Jewish people.
So let me...
About the Muslims and the Christians.
Let me ask you, Jim, in your opinion, I realize you said you're borderline atheist, why the Christian, the Jew, and the Muslim, who all recognize Abraham as the patriarch... Why can these three religions not coexist peacefully?
Mike, I'll speak for the Muslims. You know, the Muslim people, they do recognize and believe in the Christian religion as well as the Jewish religion. And they believe in them. And in the Quran, it says, when it comes to the people of the book, which are the Christians and the Jews, live and let live. Leave these people alone. So we do believe in them, and just leave them alone. We've got no problem with them. But you've got some extremists, of course, who just believe otherwise, just like you have in every religion. But in the Quran itself, the Christians and the Jews are just to be left alone. You know, God will take care of them when it's the judgment day. if they ever cut, you know, the Lord died 2,000 years ago, and... we're still waiting for judgment day, Mike.
But no, wait. I have a copy of the Quran in my house, but I haven't read very much of it. But are you saying that the Quran says, let them be, not as an act of brotherhood, but as an act of let them be because God will deal with them eventually?
Well, I mean, if they don't convert to Islam...
Well, there you go. See, and the Christians say the same thing.
Yeah, of course. Mike, I can assure you that the Muslim religion has got a lot from the Jewish and the Christians. You know, the Prophet Muhammad was born in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
He used to go to what's called now Syria and Lebanon and deal there with the Romans who were Christians and some Jews there. And he picked up some stuff from them and took it back to Saudi Arabia.
But that brings me back to the question. Since you all recognize Abraham as your patriarch, why does the Quran say, well, just wait till Judgment Day? And the Bible says, well, the Christian Bible says, just wait till Judgment Day. And the Jewish Bible says, well, Judgment Day, Schmudgment Day. We're the chosen people. Why can't the three religions just stop the nonsense?
I agree with you, Mike. And maybe because the religion is nonsense, Mike. Let's face it.
The best answer I think we can come up with. Jim, thank you. I hope you call again.
Okay, Mike, play Pink Floyd more often, please, would you?
Do what?
The Pink Floyd. Play them more often.
Pink Floyd more often. Okay, I'll do it, Jim. All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Take care. Take care. See, I can't. I wish I could understand that, why the three peoples of the book just can't seem to get it together. And I think he's right, because it is religion. I'm not aware of different factions of atheists, like, oh, I don't know, Chinese atheists that want to kill Brazilian atheists, who want to kill Indonesian atheists, who want to kill British atheists. Not when it's when religion is taken out of it. I'm not saying that there are not Indonesian nationalists who hate the British, or British who hate Indians. Based on bigotry and political craziness and chaos, but the religious angle. I would think that Muslims, Jews, and Christians would just refuse to kill each other or fight with each other, since they have the same father in their writings, in their teachings. I don't understand that. And of course, I don't need, don't send me any links to Wikipedia about why that is the way it is. It's a very elemental question to me. I realize that the answer can be stacked 10 miles high. It's very layered what the answer is. But I reduce it down to a very simplistic level so that I can understand it. Why? Or a very simplistic question so I can understand it. I'm not, some scholar, some rabbi, rabbinate, or Muslim, or Christian theologian who ponders and pores over the ancient texts trying to understand this stuff. I believe what Einstein wrote that I read tonight, that it's nonsense. But I just, if the nonsense is all based on the same patriarch, then why can't, within the framework of the nonsense, why can't these three tribes, Jew, Christian, and Muslim, just stop it? Stop the craziness. Just stop. Oh, God, what a naive question. Steve is in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Hey, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
My issue is I'm a Teamster and Local 638, work for UPS.
Mm-hmm.
Teamsters Union supported Barack Obama partly because he made the promise, we're going to work really hard, we're going to pass card check or the Employee Free Choice Act.
Right.
And I have the sad prediction that it's going to die, and they're going to make a great show of how hard they worked for it, and they'll blame Joe Lieberman or somebody. And by the way, I think Joe Lieberman campaigned for it. But they'll have some bad guys, and they'll put on a big act for us, and then it'll never pass.
Go
ahead.
Let me put you on hold a second. We'll come back after the break, because I've got to do some commercials here. But I hope that's not the case. I hope the Employee Free Choice Act goes through. But we'll come back in a second, Steve. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. Take what's there. Before the hour, we'll go back to Steve in just a second. Ron emails Mike, people are calling Rachel Maddow from Haiti. She is on MSNBC Live. What is being said is horrifying. No ambulances, hospitals have collapsed, no electricity, buildings were all of the concrete slab type construction. One woman said the fear is hundreds of thousands may be dead. Another man called it one of the worst tragedies to ever befall the planet. Please urge your listeners to donate as much as they can to the relief efforts. Yeah, thanks, Ron. That story is or that reporting is, I think it's going to be horrifying when it is fully reported. As you know, we had Rachel on the program earlier this evening, and she had to bail out. We had planned a half an hour chat or longer, but she had to bail out in order to go live on MSNBC, which is where she is now. But apparently, the 7.0 earthquake that struck Haiti was a monster. Back to Steve in Minneapolis. All right, the Employee Free Choice Act. You have a feeling that the entire labor movement is going to be betrayed.
I'm absolutely convinced of that. I think that it should have been the priority. I think if we had unions again,
mm-hmm.
if we had more than whatever it is, 13% private sector,
mm-hmm.
the other stuff would be a lot easier. You know, it's almost impossible to organize a union because the employer can get away with all kinds of illegal.
Well, didn't globalization, which is a catch-all term, and especially NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, all these organizations, weren't they the dagger in the heart of the union movement? Because union workers in this country that built this country, built the middle class, it was only through unions that we have a middle class or had a middle class in this country. People who could earn a wage with just one person working. If the two people in a family wanted to work, fine, so much the better. But one person working could handle it all thanks to, the unions brought so much, but with globalization and with capitalism, capitalism cannot coexist with unions. It cannot. Predatory capitalism can't.
You're right. Well, you're right. So they
left. They took the factories. I lived in Flint for a while. I watched that happen. They took the factories and they left. I lived in Toledo. I watched it happen there. I know how, that's why I asked the guy that called in from Toledo, what's it like there now? And it's not just the so-called Rust Belt.
Well, it's almost an idealistic answer, but at one time the idea was that the union should be international. The Teamsters is the International Brotherhood of Teamsters.
Mm-hmm.
And, UPS is, you can't move transport in
right.
Mexico, but if they had made a real effort to organize, number one, tariffs were the answer, and Bill Clinton betrayed labor by
mm-hmm.
with NAFTA, and the unions then went ahead and still supported the election. But, if you have union labor in Mexico, then, you can't necessarily move it.
Well, that's true.
They have to make good money, too.
Right.
We have to have some solidarity with them and say, well, I don't really care where you build the cars, but you're going to have to pay people a living wage wherever you build them, or mm-hmm. else... Or else we'll organize them, or else, don't.
Mm-hmm.
We'll throw them in the ocean.
But trying to get workers across borders to work together, the American worker was always, and rightfully so, I guess, proud of what he or she accomplished in terms of wages and extra benefits that went along with working in the society, and everybody seemed to be doing okay. That was the illusion anyway. But workers in other countries were told to piss off. They were told, you don't matter. I can't remember a time during the real heyday, I can't remember representatives from John L. Lewis going to South America to try to organize the miners down there. I can't remember somebody from Walter Reuther's inner circle going to Europe to organize.
Well, Reuther was a bit more of a social democrat and a left of
all the more reason he should have been working to organize international labor.
I think he was. I mean, they have the. I'm not a complete apologist for Reuther, but look at the Canadian auto workers and the UAW cooperated and made sure that, and the Canadian auto workers wound up stronger, and that saved. But, ultimately, we can organize more people in this country, and I want, if you're a Teamster or if you're a whatever, you know, the listeners, whatever union you're in, you know, I've sent a couple of emails, and now I'm going to write a paper letter and exercise in futility because I sent all this paper off on the medical insurance thing that I feel completely betrayed on. But, you know, I'm going to write to the Teamsters and say, now, when the Democrats and Barack Obama say, oh, we really couldn't do it, and it's just, it's going to be over. I don't want any more Democrats. I want the Democratic Party to collapse, and so there's room for a new party that's pro-labor. You know, this Republican light stuff is just, you know, I'm old. I'm 58 years old. I've seen this stuff all my life, and I've been fooled so many times. You know, this time I voted for Bill Clinton, even though I considered him to be kind of a, you know, a little bit too far to the right. But they were going to do something about health care. So yeah. I held my nose and voted for this, you know, NAFTA sleazeball.
Hey, Steve, there's the music. We're flat out of time. But trust me, I hear what you're saying. I've been pro-union, pro-organized labor, you know, all my life. I'm an active union member now, so I know what you're saying. Hey, listen, we got to go, pal. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care, okay? Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Do you know one?